This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
This lecture was given originally on February 21 at King's College, London University. I was invited to give this talk as an official presentation at King's College, and the dean himself invited me to use the subject, A Critique of Liberalism. So that is the theme, A Critique of Liberalism. In beginning, let's notice, as we come to a question of examining liberalism and speaking expressly of theological liberalism, one must understand that our criticism, in a negative sense, of liberalism does not come because of a rejection of scholarship. And this is a thing that certainly must be said immediately at the beginning. We who would say we stand in the historic stream of Christianity, and many to whom we look back, that we would claim are first class in every way in the realm of scholarship. One could think of Robert Dick Wilson, for example, at Princeton Theological Seminary before it became liberal, and point out to many others that spent a lifetime on textual study in order to determine the best text. And it would seem obvious immediately that we who believe that the Bible is a propositional revelation from God to man naturally have a deep interest in finding the best possible text, so that therefore it should not be surprising that we have had an interest in scholarship, textual scholarship, not in the negative sense or what would be known as the higher criticism in the United States, but in the sense of what should usually be called lower criticism in the United States, of trying to determine the best possible text that one could have. In other words, we who believe the Bible is the Word of God in its original text naturally have the greatest possible interest through scholarship in trying to determine what that best text is. So let us begin by emphasizing that our criticism of liberalism in theology has nothing to do with a criticism of scholarship as such, nor even a scholarship of careful textual study as such. Rather, our criticism of liberalism falls at a different point, and that is, we are critical of the whole liberal structure because of its presuppositions. Now, by liberalism, we are not just thinking of liberalism in contrast to, say, neo-orthodox thought, but as we shall show, to us, liberalism is an entire structure, beginning back long ago in Germany, but coming up to the very present and encompassing neo-orthodox thought. So that rather than liberalism being considered as prior to Karl Barth, as far as we are concerned, liberalism encompasses everything from the beginning of naturalistic theological studies down to the present day. And in all of these, what our contention would be, and our basic criticism, is that the presupposition of this whole structure is wrong. We must understand that what we call liberalism started in the German universities now a long time ago. And it started in the German universities by the acceptance of a certain presupposition. And that presupposition we may speak of as the uniformity of natural causes. And at that time, in the German universities, the faculties were largely dealing with the uniformity of natural causes. And when liberalism began in the German universities, it simply meant that the theological faculties moved over in their presuppositions into the position of naturalism and accepted the uniformity of natural causes. I would make a suggestion here as to why this occurred. It would seem to me that if one studies the Reformation, one finds a living orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that is a flaming fire, a living thing. But after a certain amount of time, this living orthodoxy became what I would think of as merely repetitive orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that continued to be repeated as far as the verbalizations are concerned, but nevertheless, in reality, was only repetitive in the sense that those who were the theologians who were making this repetition of the orthodox formulations, yet nevertheless, it was not a flaming reality to them. So you would have a repetitive orthodoxy, or we might say a dead orthodoxy, surrounded at that time with a sea of naturalism. And being surrounded by a sea of naturalism, they holding an orthodox position, which is supernatural, yet without any real commitment, in many cases certainly, but just repeating the orthodox phrases, the thing was not strong enough. And as the consensus grew round about, and the sea of naturalism became overwhelming, simply because it was only a repetitive situation, a repetitive orthodoxy, I think they simply gave in. In other words, my contention at this particular point would be that they didn't give in because men found any particular facts at that time that made them give in, but rather that they simply at this time conformed to the naturalistic consensus, the naturalistic sea which was surrounding them. In other words, they brought the theological faculty in line with the other faculties which were also living in a realm of naturalism. From that time on to the present, the general flow of theology has been naturalistic. Now we must understand what we mean by this. That is it's naturalistic, that they had a totality of the uniformity of cause and effect. And this, of course, became an entirely opposite framework, total framework, from what Christian theology had been previously. You must understand that it's not that Christian theology denies the uniformity of cause and effect in the general functioning of the external world. It has not done this. But rather, they made a closed system of the uniformity of cause and effect, which is a very, very different thing indeed. So in biblical Christianity, you have a uniformity of cause and effect in the external world, but nevertheless, it's not a closed system. God can do two things into this world of cause and effect. He can bring external knowledge to men by speaking to men in the midst of the normal world. And secondly, he can operate into the law of cause and effect in what we would speak of as a miracle. So it is not that there isn't a place for the uniformity of cause and effect in the Christian system, but it's not a closed system of the uniformity of cause and effect. Non-closeness must be seen in the two areas. First, of knowledge, that God can give knowledge that men wouldn't find out for themselves on the basis of merely the uniformity of cause and effect. He can give it to them in a propositional form. And secondly, he is not a slave to what the Bible claims he has made, but at his own desire, his own will, he can operate down into the law of cause and effect. So here you must see that theology has moved over completely onto the other side when they accepted the naturalistic presuppositions. But be careful. You understand where it moved over. It did not move over in that Christian position has no place for the uniformity of cause and effect. That isn't it. It's simply the question of whether the cause and effect is a unified field, a totally closed system, or whether God can speak down to men in the midst of this world, and whether God can operate in it. So the Christian position has two parts. The uniformity of cause and effect, but God being able to communicate knowledge into this to men, and can work in it, down into it any time that he desires. When the German theologians became naturalists, and accepted the other set of presuppositions, what they really did was simply to make the uniformity of cause and effect a closed system. So that from that time on, But on the basis of the presuppositions, they had no place for God giving knowledge down to men outside of this, and they had no place for God working into it. Now, this is what occurred. So from this time on, we find that the general flow of theology has been naturalistic in the uniformity of cause and effect, which is quite opposite from the total Christian framework, because the total Christian framework has a supernatural ness in it, a supernaturalness of beginning, a supernaturalness that God can communicate propositional truth into the world of history, and that God, when he desires quite freely, can operate down into the normal world. Now, from this time on, when men accepted these presuppositions a long time ago in Germany, 250 years ago, something like this, we've come to a very interesting phenomena. And the interesting phenomena is that from that time to this, theology, after it became naturalistic, theology has tended to follow the curve of secular naturalism. And here is what I would feel the heart of a careful critique of naturalistic theology or liberal theology, is that in reality, you're not finding it saying anything different than the surrounding consensus. So that what you find is whatever the surrounding naturalistic, non-theological consensus is, you find that the theological liberalism has tended then to conform. So that if you drew a curve, a graph, you would find that as the, and this is what we want to look at tonight, as the shifts came in the naturalistic secular consensus round about the theology, as the shifts came, the theological naturalism simply followed the same curve a few years later. So if you were drawing a series of graphs and you had a red line for secular naturalism, and then you had a blue line for theological naturalism, whatever the curve of secular naturalism did, just a short time afterwards on the temporal level, along would come the other curve following it almost exactly, which of course is something then which can be given as a reason for having a negative critique of liberal theology. So let us notice, therefore, and this is the point of what follows, the showing, the thesis, the statement of the thesis, that the naturalistic theology simply followed the secular naturalism, the surrounding secular naturalism. Now let us go back and think of what the situation was in the secular world, the secular naturalism, at the time prior to Hegel. What you find in the secular naturalism prior to Hegel is that men optimistically thought that on the basis of rationalism, they would rationally be able to find a unified answer to knowledge and to life. Now, it's worth analyzing these points. What I've said is that secular naturalism prior to Hegel optimistically thought that they could rationalistically, on a rational basis, find a unified answer to knowledge and life. These three points, actually, are very worth noting and thinking about. Rationalistically means that man, beginning with himself, looking merely outward on the basis of the naturalistic things about one, with no outside information, could begin to build a universal out from himself. We're talking about secular naturalism now, remember. He thought that he could do this rationally. And as those of you here at Farrell House know, we would make a very sharp distinction between rationalism and rational. The rationalistic means that a man begins with himself and builds outwardly. In this sense, it is a synonym for humanism. Rational is an entirely different idea. The rational means, simply on the basis of the basic move of classical logic, that if you have A, it is not non-A. In other words, that your methodology in the field of epistemology is that a methodology of antithesis. That if a thing is true, the opposite is not true. And this is that which is rational. And in secular naturalism, prior to Hegel, men optimistically thought that on a basis of rationalism, they could rationally find a unified answer to knowledge and to life. A unified answer is the third point here. They could find an answer, a rational answer, that would encompass all of knowledge and all of life in all the categories of knowledge and all the categories of life. Now, actually, this optimistic hope goes all the way back to the Greeks and before the Greeks. So this is exactly then the place prior to Hegel, which was the first part of the curve of secular naturalism. Now, how did liberal theological naturalism follow this? It echoed the secular optimism by optimistically thinking that on the basis of naturalistic objective scholarship, they could find the historical Jesus by getting rid of the supernatural in the biblical accounts. And one must see that this is exactly in the field of theology what was the case in the larger field of general naturalism. So what was true in the surrounding consensus of general naturalism, this optimistic concept, was true also as they accepted the presuppositions and the theological faculties in the narrower realm of theology. And what they thought they could do is to take the biblical accounts and merely on the basis of objective naturalistic scholarship be able to separate the wheat from the chaff from their viewpoint, in the sense of being able to get rid of all the supernatural and therefore finding the historical Jesus. This was their optimistic, naturalistic hope. This is old liberalism. This is what's usually known of as old liberalism. So now this is the first part of our curve in red and blue, as I suggested. First, the secular naturalism and then the theological naturalism. And these are exactly parallel, one in a general area, a large area, and the other in a specific discipline of theology. The second step in the curve, where the curve breaks, is with Kant and Hegel, and then Kierkegaard. Hegel, Kant, was the last one who thought in the old way, just what I was describing before. With Hegel and Soren Kierkegaard, you come to the first break in the curve of the surrounding secular naturalism. And with this, rationalism, rationalistic philosophy, decided that on a rational basis, they were not going to find a unified knowledge of life, a unified answer to knowledge and life. So now here you come into attention. Previously, they thought they could maintain three points. Rationalism, the man beginning from himself and working outwardly. The rational, if it's A, it is not non-A. If a thing is true, the opposite is not true. A methodology in the field of epistemology of antithesis, and in a unified field of knowledge. And now suddenly they find a tension, and something has to give, because they find that they're not going to be able to hang on to their old optimism. Something must go. And this, as you know from some of my other lectures, I would say is the place where they arrived at no exit, which I think is exactly so. It's no exit. Now what happened in this second portion of the curve when they found something had to give in the surrounding consensus of secular naturalism. What happened in rationalistic theology? Interestingly enough, they came to the same dilemma in their smaller field. And that is that they found that they were not objectively going to be able to separate the historical Jesus from the supernatural. It's really intriguing to see the exactness of the curve here. So they suddenly found that in their own narrow discipline, they were not going to be able to separate the historical Jesus from the supernatural. And the reason for this is that the two portions, as they viewed the two portions of the biblical text, especially the gospel, were found to be too tangled to separate the two parts, which they thought they would be able easily to separate on the basis of objective scholarship. They found that they could not untangle, on the basis of objective scholarship, the supernatural and the historical Jesus. So they found that, on one hand, if they really could not accept the supernatural, they had no historical Jesus. And on the other hand, if they were going to have a historical Jesus, they had to accept the supernatural. It's very simple and very profound. And they couldn't accept the supernatural because of their presuppositions. This was their orthodoxy. Their orthodoxy was a naturalistic series of presuppositions, that you had a uniformity of cause and effect, which ruled out the possibility of God giving propositional knowledge from outside, and it ruled out God's working into the external historical world. So on the basis of their supernatural, they couldn't accept the supernatural. But the dilemma was that they found that they weren't going to be able to untangle the skein, that the thing was so tangled that they couldn't get, that they had to make this horrible choice. They either had to throw away the supernatural and then have no historical Jesus, or accept the historical Jesus, but this carried with it the supernatural. So interestingly enough, in the limited field of the theological discipline, they came to exactly the same dilemma as the larger naturalistic philosophy, rationalistic philosophy, came to at the time of Hegel and Kant. Is exactly the same, but in a narrower field. So now you come then to the third step. The third step. The first step was the optimism, and the second step, the break in the curve, was the dilemma. So now we come to the third step in the curve, the third break in the curve. And now we're dealing again with a secular rationalism. We're back to the secular rationalism. Secular rationalism at that point, at that moment, had two possibilities. If it was to maintain its old rational epistemology and methodology, and if it was to maintain its old hope of a unified field of knowledge. And two things are before it, you see, possibilities, two possibilities, and that's all. If they were going to hang on to their rational concept and the concept of a unified field of knowledge, if they were going to hang on to these two, then they had two possibilities, and the one was total nihilism. This would be the one rational possibility. One rational possibility would be that in the entire unified field of knowledge and life, one would accept that everything was junk. Just a total nihilism, total blackness. They could do this and maintain their rational position, that if the thing is true, the opposite is false, and they could say this was true over the entire unified field of knowledge and life. That was a possibility. They had a second possibility, and that is to accept knowledge from outside the rationalistic, humanistic concept. This was their other possibility. In other words, they could have returned to the historic Christian position of revelation. But of course, now you find here's their tension. They could, in the first place, they could hang on to their rationalism. If they hung on to this, they had the possibility of being nihilistic. But of course, they couldn't be rationalistic and accept the supernatural on the basis of revelation. This they couldn't do. Or they could hang on to the rational on the concept of a unified field of knowledge, but then they would have to give up their rationalism. That's been a very hard moment for these men to face this terrible choice. And this was their possibilities. If they were going to hang on to the total, if they were going to hang on to a total rationalism, the rational and a unified field of knowledge, they could say it was nihilistic, or they could turn around and accept revelation. And this was their only two possibilities, and there weren't three. So now you have this, you feel this, how interesting this configuration is. You can give up your rationalism by taking revelation. And then you can hang on to the rational, and you can hang on to the unified field of knowledge. But they did the unthinkable. Now we're talking about the secular world at this time. They did something that previous to this time had always been considered unthinkable. And that is, they split the field of knowledge. Prior to this, nobody had ever thought of this as a possibility. I don't mean you couldn't find some minor person who might have, but it would have been a rare, rare thing. So they cut the knot, as it were. They could have been nihilistic, or they could have given up their rationalism and accepted revelation. And at that particular moment, in a discussion group, such as we have here in La Brie, we would have said, you must choose. And then suddenly they came along with Hegel and Kierkegaard, and they cut the knot. They did the unthinkable to, as far as all previous educated men were concerned. They split the field of knowledge. So therefore, they made a choice. They held onto the presupposition of rationalism by letting go of the rational in a unified field. It doesn't seem possible when you see it this way, that this is exactly what they did. But they did. They turned their back on everything that educated men had considered as imperative in all the previous centuries back to the time of the Greeks. So you come to Hegel and Kierkegaard setting forth a secular existentialism in what we call here at La Brie the upper and lower stories. The lower story being the rational and the logical. And in this area, you're only dealing with mathematics and machines, and all men, therefore, are only machines. But they split the field of knowledge and made an upstairs. The upstairs being the non-rational and the non-logical. And this is, of course, the place of secular existentialism. And you have Sartre, and you have Carl Jaspers, and you have Heidegger. And each one of these put forth a proposition in his own way of finding a meaning to life in the upper story by keeping the upper story completely separated from the lower story, keeping the non-rational and the non-logical entirely separated from the rational and the logical, acknowledging that on the basis of the rational and the logical, no one could find a meaning to man, and yet putting forth a new concept, and that is that it was possible on the basis of a non-rational and the non-logical to somehow validate man's hopes of being man. And, of course, you have the three great distinctions in Sartre. You have the concept of validating yourself by an act of the will, but this act of the will is itself is absurd because you can validate yourself by acting in either direction, at any point, with an act of the will. The illustration I would use, always sharp thing, is that If you saw an old lady walking along the road and you stopped and picked her up in the rain, you would be validating your will. But if you made your motor go faster and you ran her down and killed her, it would be an equally valid validation of the will. So it's an act of the will which is neutral. There is no antithesis in this. You have left the methodology of antithesis. So in this kind of an act of the will, it doesn't matter which direction the act of the will acts. It acts to the left, it could equally act to the right. It makes no difference whatsoever that you have a totally absurd situation. The second man is Carl Jaspers, who speaks of the final experience. The final experience, which is also non-rational and non-logical, here in Switzerland, and then, of course, the German Heidegger. And Heidegger put forth the concept of a validating of one's existence and the hope of purpose on the basis of what he called dread. This dread is also totally absurd. Dread, in the older Heidegger, must always be separated from the idea of fear. He makes very clear his distinction. Fear always has an object. You are afraid of a lion, let's say. On the other hand, dread is merely that strange feeling you have that something more is there. Something like this. Now, all these three men, therefore, the existential thinking, split the field of knowledge. They were able, therefore, to hang on to their rationalism, but at the expense of a unified field of knowledge and at the expense of a total rationality. Another area, of course, where this is very strong is in the area of drugs. So you have Aldous Huxley in the Anglo-Saxon world putting forth a first-order experience on the basis of drunks, coming down to the new LSD. And more the LSD experiments are in the direction of showing that indeed they consider a unity between the old religious first-order experience of the Jiru, let's say, in India, a non-rational, non-logical experience, and the LSD drugs. Sometime soon, I want to spend more time with you on this book of Leary. Based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in which he connects the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the new LSD experiences. He uses the text in the Tibetan Book of the Dead of Evans Wentz, who's an Englishman. It was originally printed, published by Oxford University Press. They pick it up and use it as a basis of bringing together the LSD experience and the Tibetan experience, religious experience, a non-rational, non-logical situation. But whether one is dealing with Sartre or Carl Jaspers or Heidegger, the continental existentialist, or the Anglo-Saxon Aldous Huxley with his first-order experience, or the new American emphasis on the LSD, in each of the cases, basically it is the same thing. You have given up, in order to hold on to the rationalism, one has given up a rational answer in the unified field of knowledge. In a unified field of knowledge. And that's the secular. That's what happened when the secular naturalism came to its crisis. Now, notice that that's exactly the same thing that naturalistic theology did at the time of Karl Barth. This is Karl Barth's contribution. Karl Barth's contribution, this little bit that they used to give about Karl Barth so much that liberalism had come to a wall, and then a Swiss pastor rang a bell, is the way that was often spoken of. Well, what bell did he ring? Well, the bell he rang was the same answer that the secular naturalists had come to. He rang the bell of the acceptance of the same answer in the field of theology. And that simply was that the Bible has lots of scientific and historic mistakes in it. Basically, it is scientifically and historically false. I wouldn't say it all was false, but in general. But nevertheless, on the basis of crisis, one could find religious truth in that which was historically and scientifically false. Now, you'll notice that this is an exactly duplicated area, but in the limited field of the Bible. Just as in the old theology, the old liberal theology, the optimistic naturalism was found, you found exact duplication in the narrower field of theology in the reference to the historical Jesus and the supernatural. So just as in that old situation, you had an exact duplication in the localized discipline, in contrast to the whole surrounding thing, so you find Karl Barth doing the same thing. What the existentialist did in the whole field, he did in the field of biblical studies. So regardless of what else Karl Barth did, his big contribution is a divided concept of truth. The thing may be religiously true, even though it is scientifically and historically false. This is his basic contribution. Now, therefore, the next point, coming to the secular naturalism again, remember what we're doing, our critique of liberalism, liberal theology, is that it's nothing new at all. And not only that, but in each case, it simply follows the curve of the position which secular naturalism had previously taken. Now we come to the next point in this, and that is secular naturalism's dilemma. Secular naturalism's dilemma on the basis of accepting the existential position. And its dilemma is this, and that is that one cannot communicate an existential experience if the existential experience is really in a totally non-rational and non-logical realm. It's very simple. You can't verbalize it. You can't communicate it. Now, the difficulty with this is that it isn't only that you can't communicate it to others, but you can't talk to oneself. And this is the ironical thing, that these men, having begun with boastings of rational, of being so rational, suddenly find that they have espoused a position by dividing the field of knowledge and saying that the really important things of life are in the non-rational and the non-logical. They have espoused a position where they cannot communicate with other people or to themselves. This is their dilemma. For the simple fact is that one cannot communicate with oneself or to anyone else except on the basis of antithesis. So you have this kind of a situation. You have the situation that the old classical logic was that if a thing is true, the opposite is not true. And this kind of basis you can talk. You can talk, for example, to yourself, because basically one must talk to oneself in verbalizations as well as talking to other people in verbalizations. But when you give up the methodology of antithesis, you can't talk to yourself. Because the funny part is, and the I don't mean funny in being humorous, but the ironical part and the sad part is, when men come to this horrible situation for themselves, is the fact that if I say I reject the antithesis, I reject the methodology of antithesis, the only way I can say this is on the basis of verbalization by antithesis. And this is a real dilemma. So if I say I reject antithesis, you see, the only way that is a meaningful sentence is by speaking in terms of antithesis. It means you do reject antithesis and you really don't accept it. So the curious part is that even in their own heads, they come to dead center, so they can't communicate with themselves except on the basis of the methodology which they have rejected. Right? I hope you feel this. It's really a very strong point. It's impossible to say I reject antithesis except by using the verbalization of antithesis. And so suddenly the dilemma is that man can't even talk to himself in his own head. Therefore, what you find is that modern man is in a terrible dilemma. On the lower level of the rational and the logical, man is a machine and can't find any purpose for himself. But when he moves upstairs into the non-rational and the non-logical, to the extent in which he's consistent in really thinking in the terms of the non-logical and the non-rational and keeping it a complete watertight dilemma, dichotomy from the rational and the logical, to that extent, in the upstairs, he is just a Greek shade. And that's all. So in the downstairs, man is a machine and he's dead, but in the upstairs, he's just a vapor. A vapor that can't even talk to itself. And this really is where these men have come. And this is one can see a very serious difficulty. Downstairs, man is dying, man is dead, and upstairs you have a mysticism of a very fantastic sort. A mysticism that cannot deal with content. So the old Roman Catholic mystic, or the old Protestant mystic, or the old Chinese mystic, was a mystic with a concept that there's somebody there who can communicate in the terms of content. Modern man's mysticism is a very much more overwhelming concept. It is a mysticism with no certainty that anybody's there, and it never has content. And the best illustration of this, of course, is Heidegger, as the older man Heidegger, where he says, you just listen to the language. You just listen to the language. And it's not the content of the language, you just listen to the poet. It's not the content of the language, it's not the content of the poet, it's just that there are the flowing words of the poet. And this is a mysticism beyond any mysticism that anybody's ever put forth in the past. You must understand here a difference in Heidegger's linguistic emphasis from the English linguistic analysis. The Anglo-Saxon linguistic analysis, and in England today, linguistic analysis has pretty well won the field in almost all the universities. Especially thought of as starting at Cambridge, but today it's almost dominant everywhere. And in the English linguistic analysis, you define the terms with great care, and theoretically only use terms that you have already adequately and scientifically defined. The new mysticism is in a different direction. The Heidegger's use of language is an entirely different direction. Heidegger's use of language is without any definitions. As a matter of fact, as soon as you start defining them, you spoil Heidegger's mysticism. So it's interesting that on both sides of the channel, the emphasis today is on language, but in two different directions. In England, the emphasis, theoretically anyway, is on a scientifically defined language before you put words together. Heidegger, on this side of the channel, in the later Heideggers, emphasis is on the use of language, but it's always an undefined language. It's just a flow of poetic expression in which one is overwhelmed by a mystical meaning that there must be something there because, after all, there's language there. But this is a fantastic form of mysticism. This, of course, is not just shut up to Heidegger. As I point out in other lectures, you have Bernstein's Kadish with the concept of there is no God, but more or less, I will make one with my art. Salvador Dali, we've pointed out, is this kind of a modern mystic. John Cage, not thinking anything is there, and yet producing music by chance. And here now you come to the LSD experiments, and as I've pointed out, the parallelism between the new LSD experiments and the Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, bringing it all in one nice tight circle. Just this, just before I gave this lecture, at King's, when I say I gave it, February 21, but nevertheless I had just read the February 28 Newsweek. It's a nice American way of dating magazines in advance that made this possible. And in that particular thing, there was a large analysis of McLuhan, who is of the University of Toronto. He's the director of the University of Toronto's Center for Culture and Technology. And he is the most far-out man today in communications. And his whole concept of communications is in the same direction. It really is poetry. So someday perhaps we will look into this a little bit more carefully in McLuhan. But just to say that he divides all the mediums of communication up into two kinds, what he calls the hot and the cold, or the cool. Now, by medium of communication, he would contrast, for example, anything that's printed, the press, anything that's printed in contrast to, say, television. And the hot communications is one, would be one specially connected with a printed thing, but it also would be radio, in which it is a good communication for content and data. And then in contrast to this, he would make what he calls the cool communications, in which data isn't so important, but you get an immediate response merely by the medium itself. And he would say television is the ideal cool medium. So therefore, interestingly enough, it's exactly the same as we find in all these other areas of man's living today. You have a first order experience, which brings complete involvement, and never mind the content. And I think all these things do hang together, and terrifyingly so. So therefore, he would take an American businessman and say, put your money in advertising, not in hot mediums, that you might be able to get more content, but you'll get less response. But rather put your money into cool mediums, and who cares about the content as long as they go out and buy your product? But of course you can sell anything this way, including forms of government. So the interesting thing is that you have a titanic uniformity, a monolithicness about all this. Whether you're dealing with the philosopher Heidegger's listen to the poet, whether you listen to Bernstein, Kadish, Salvador Dali, look at Salvador Dali's painting, listen to John Cage's music, you begin to take LSD, fall into the LSD experiences, or you begin to commit yourself to the new fields of communication. Now the interesting thing is that this thing on McLuhan ends with the emphasis on poet, which I think is terrific. So the last paragraph, next to the last paragraph, it's subheading poet. Marshall, that's his name, Marshall McLuhan. Marshall says, as formal colleague, claims he's a scientist. I've never agreed with that. I think he's a poet. You can't argue with him, just as you can't argue with Tennyson or Browning. Certain McLuhan's scholarly outlook is poetic. And then it goes on. So the interesting thing is, here you have Heidegger saying, listen to the poet, the contentless flow of words. Never mind its content, never mind the data, just listen to the flow of words. And now this man picks it up, and he puts it into the modern fields of communication. Choose a medium to sell your product that brings immediate involvement without, you don't bother with the content, and therefore he's the poet. Well, these things are unified. This is where modern secular position has come. They have cut the field, a unified field of knowledge, and they have this dilemma. Downstairs, man is more and more the machine. Upstairs, you're falling into a mysticism, whether it's Heidegger's sense of non-analyzed language, or whether it is a way to look at life and sell things. Not because there's any meaning to it, in a sense, but just you get across an involvement, a mystical involvement, which sounds awfully like indeed, the LSD experiments, or what one would have pictured for him in the Hindu concept of the Hindu Jiru. So now this is, remember what I'm talking about is their dilemma. What they did was to hang on, the secular man hung on to his rationalism at the expense of a rational answer in the unified field of knowledge. Theology comes along and does the same thing in Karl Barth and onward by separating the historic and the scientific in the Bible from religious values, an upper and lower story. The dilemma of the secular then is that it leaves man downstairs as a machine and upstairs with this mysticism, not being sure anybody's there and never with content. Now, what about theology? What has theology done? Well, in my critique of liberal theology, I'd simply say that the old thing simply continues because modern liberal theological thought has now come to this exact same place that the secular naturalistic thought has come to. So you have now two directions to modern theology. You have the downstairs, the rational and the logical. And where does this bring you? This brings you to the God is dead theology. Rather, one might think, the terminus of this viewpoint. One would wonder where it goes next after God is dead. But do you notice that the God is dead theology is only in theology exactly that man is only a machine in the secular theology? It's exactly parallel. As a matter of fact, Cox and some of these other men acknowledge that they're only expressing a humanistic thing in this kind of terms. So in the theology, the downstairs, man comes into a meaninglessness and the expression, and you can express this theologically, in the God is dead sort of a situation. But now what about the upstairs theologically? Well, of course, the upstairs theologically is still following along the secular curve. And that is, you have a set of religious values that's not open, in which content has very little importance, and it's not open to verification. So just as in the secular position, the existential experience is not open to communication, so in the modern upstairs theology, the modern mystical upstairs theology, anything that is said is not open to verification. And I would always quote at this particular place, this lovely little thing of Byzance, who in the Objection to Christian Belief, it's about page 90, 91, something like this, Byzance turns around from shooting at the historic Christian position, and he turns his guns for a few moments on the neo-Orthodox position. He swings it around, he just goes rat-tat-tat like this, toward the neo-Orthodox position. And he says, and if you tell me the strength of this position is that it is not open to verification, I will tell you that that which is not open to verification leads only to that which is not open to verification and call nonsense by its name. And this is a very profound sense, and one he knows what he's talking about. That in reality, that you seem to escape the dilemma of discussion on the scientific and the historic level. If you say it's just all upstairs, it's not open to verification, it would seem to be a very strong position. But what it really is nonsense because you can't talk about it. So the funny part is that just as the secular naturalism, in accepting this act of desperation, what I call the act of despair, and splitting the unified field of knowledge, has come to this very strange position of man being a machine on one level, and the other level, man being a Greek shade and not open to communication, even with himself. Curiously enough, the theology, his liberal theology, has come to exactly the same place. And what is put forth on one level is God is dead, but on the other level that you put forth theological words which are not open to verification and which content has no importance. So my critique of liberalism up to this point is simply to say, you see, after all, not only has it accepted the same presuppositions as the secular naturalism, but it has been forced to the same curve, merely coming after a little while, which doesn't give one great sense of pride in liberal theology. Instead of all these magnificent, daring things, such as one finds in Honest to God, instead of finding these are trailblazers and breathtakers, it's all old hat before they're ever announced. And once one begins to sense this, one begins to understand the real critique, as I would see it, of liberal theology. It's always old-fashioned. It is always simply following the previous steps taken by the surrounding naturalistic culture because it's caught in the same web and has no possible other answers, I would suggest. Therefore, in conclusion, liberalism in theology is really nothing different from secular naturalism. Liberalism in theology is really nothing different from secular naturalism. And by this, I mean liberalism on a wider sense than usually is thought of. That is, the old liberalism and then the neo-orthodoxy after Barth. I'm talking about a total structure from the time when in the German universities, the theological faculties took over the naturalistic presuppositions, sweeping right down through Barth up to the present. And in all this entire period, theological liberalism is nothing really different from secular naturalism. The only difference between the two is that they're using different terms. That secularism uses secular terms and religious naturalism, liberalism, uses religious terms. The distinction is not that there's a different position. They're simply stating the same position, basically, using different terms. However, the religious liberalism does have what seems to be an advantage. And that is the religious terms, in contrast to the secular terms, the religious terms give an illusion of communication. And this is where they would seem to have an advantage. I've said that the secular existential experience, the existential experience is never open to communication, even to oneself. But by using religious terms rather than secular terms, you give an illusion of communication. So when you say God, you seem to say something. When you say Jesus Christ, you seem to say something. But it's not because there's any real meaning to these words in the religious liberalism. It is only an illusion of communication. Now let us notice that this illusion of communication turns on the connotation of the religious words rather than the definition of the religious words. And this is really a very important thing to understand. That every word has two parts. It has a definition and a connotation. And when a writer is writing, he must be very, very careful not only of the definition, the dictionary definition, but the connotation. Because you can have what would be a synonym in the dictionary, and yet nevertheless you change the entire thrust of the sentence by the connotation of the word chosen, which on the definition might be a synonym. Now then, what you have, let us notice, is that the religious naturalist, by using religious terms, has an illusion of communication, not because of the definition of the word he uses, but only by what is carried with the connotation of the religious word. So therefore, you have Carl Gustav Jung has the concept of a collective unconscious, and I would reject it. His concept of the collective unconscious. But having said this, nevertheless, it must be understood that certain words are rooted into the consciousness of the race, so that even if you change the definition, it brings a certain connotation. And this is true of religious words above all other words. So as soon as you use the word God, you seem to be dealing with personality. Something like this. You can use the word Jesus Christ, without any content and without any real definition, and yet at the same time it releases something in men's thinking on the basis of the connotation out of the structure of the race and the racial thinking. Now, in India, you wouldn't were to use the word Christ, you'd use the word Vishnu, something like this, and you'd have the same results. But notice now, therefore, these men seem to have an advantage because they give an illusion of communication, but the illusion communication is never because they define the content of their word, including Jesus Christ, but only because of the connotation and the emotional factors connected with the connotation. Notice how closely this is identified with Heidegger's linguistic use of "listen to the poet." You can feel this, and how. And what you're in when you think of what McLuhan's, or whatever the fellow's name is, McLuhan's concept of cool mediums. You don't, never mind the content, it really doesn't matter. You just get an immediate involvement, immediate response. So the interesting thing is that suddenly you realize this is a very powerful thing these men have laid hold of. It's not that they deal with any meaning. The content of the word Jesus Christ is nil. But nevertheless, they have laid hold upon not defined terms and symbols, but undefined terms that nevertheless, because of their being rooted back into the race, produce an illusion of communication and a response. So therefore, in one way, the religious naturalist has nothing to offer better than the secular naturalist. But in another way, they have. They seem to have. Because there's a way to get off dead center here from their viewpoint. In a situation where you don't find any meaning to man, yet nevertheless, by giving this illusion of communication, you can seem to get off dead center. But now notice that one must make a choice here. One must say, well, if that's all there is to it, really it is nothing. And as far as any real meaning is concerned, as far as any real content is concerned, it is nothing. It's really nothing. Nothing squared. But on the other hand, there is another possibility. That, and while on one hand it is nothing, on the other hand, it can be terrific in the sociological situation. Because on one hand it is nothing, but on the other hand, this kind of a thing of the something reaching down into the wellsprings of the people, not by meaning, not by content, but only by illusion and by connotation, this is totally open to manipulation by the surrounding sociological and cultural consensus. So it's perfectly possible using this sort of a thing, which gives an illusion of meaning on the basis of the connotation, for the surrounding society to use this to set up a set of sociological and governmental arbitrary absolutes on the basis of these manipulated religious motivations. And I don't think for a moment this is theoretical. I think it's exactly what is in the direction of happening. So on one hand, you can say it's nothing. On the other hand, it's terrifyingly something. And especially when you begin to realize the new communication study of a man like Nick Luhan. You have a terrifying situation here. You talk about sublineal results. This is sublineal down deep into the wellsprings of people. Something that means nothing by definition, which really is nothing. And yet by giving an illusion of communication on the basis of connotation rooted into the memory of the race, able to bring immediate involvement and immediate responses. And surely then open in a terrifying way to setting up arbitrary absolutes in the sociological and the governmental field. It's for this reason that I think my guess is that liberal theology has a future, but it's a terrifying future. So as I would see liberalism, it has been, as it were, the tail on the dog for a long time, as I've indicated. But I think now, if it continues in the direction it's going in, theology may be the queen of sciences. But not the queen of sciences because it's really teaching anything. But only that will provide in our present lack of sociological form, in the midst of our present sociological chaos, it will provide an instrumentality for setting up arbitrary absolutes open to manipulation by the surrounding culture. And of course this is terrifying to anyone who understands anything. It, once again, one can say previously, my negative critique of liberalism is that it has been the tail on the dog. Now, my critique would be worse and stronger, and that is, it is a perfect implement for totalitarian manipulation. I would say that this has already taken place. It isn't just theoretical. So that you have in the United States, for example, a very strange phenomenon that some of these religious men and others are very happy to use the religious motivation, Jesus Christ, let us say, for the situation in the southern part of the United States in the racial question. This is following Jesus Christ. And yet at the same time, when these same students return to a place like Berkeley and do something of the same nature, a lot of these same men then try to cut the thing short. Not because it's open to any differences in real differences that one can point out in the area of reason, but just simply now because it's beginning to cut in the wrong direction. So it's perfectly possible to use the word Jesus Christ in a certain situation, and then in an exactly parallel situation, use the word Jesus Christ to cut the thing short in the other direction. A set of arbitrary absolutes deep into the wellsprings of the consciousness of the people rooted back into the connotation of these words. An illusion. I think it's the same in Britain, where you have these men in the Cambridge theology producing the Cambridge morality, in the name of Jesus Christ, setting up a sexual freedom for sexual relationship outside of marriage. And yet a lot of these same men, when the thing begins to come to a certain place in a cultural situation, will use the name Jesus Christ to try to stop it. Not because there's any logic between a difference between the two situations, but just simply because of a sociological situation. So consequently, this is not just theoretical at all. And on one hand, therefore, you can say religious liberalism has nothing to offer that secular naturalism doesn't have. On the other hand, you can say, but it gives an illusion of communication. And then you can say, well, that's nothing, because it's not open to definition. But on the other hand, it's terrifyingly something in the force of the possible force of manipulation. Or you can say it another way in closing, as to my critique of liberalism, and that is liberal theology is totally under the line of anthropology. It's totally under the line of anthropology. With nothing over that line of anthropology, except either the philosophic other or the impersonal all there is. So liberal theology is always under the ceiling of anthropology. And on the other side of the ceiling of anthropology, there's only two possibilities that these people put forth. And that is, in the other side of anthropology, all religious things are in the area of the philosophic other. Or, and this is a direction more and more, towards some sort of vague pantheism or pan-everythingism, so that you have on the other side of anthropology, being with a capital B encompassing everything impersonally. That's another way to say the position of modern liberal theology. And this means, therefore, that the modern naturalistic theology, the modern liberalism, is in the circle of the finite, with no meaning nor authority greater than man can give it. So, on the basis of their presuppositions, which they have followed from the beginning, in a very stringent fashion, usually anyway, very orthodox to the naturalistic presuppositions, of which I spoke at the beginning, on this basis, the only meaning and the only authority that religion has is the religion, or is the meaning or the authority that man can give it. That's the only meaning and authority it has. Or you can say, in absolute conclusion here, in other words, man is on his own with only religious words rather than religious truth or religious meaning. And so, this is another way to speak of that which religious naturalism is, or liberalism. The man is really on his own, and he has religious words, but no religious meaning, and no religious truth. You just have words. Till it's God behind God. His word, God, would be a perfect illustration. What you're left with is the word God. What you're left with is the word Jesus Christ. But only the word. And of course, again, if you're thinking clearly, you'll realize this is back into Heidegger's Listen to the Poet. So liberalism, therefore, is left with, religious liberalism is left with religious words. And then that's all. Now this would end my critique of liberalism, but with this one, addition. And that is that there are indeed vast differences within the flow of religious liberalism. The old-fashioned liberalism must be distinguished from the religious liberalism that is existential on this side of Bart. Then if one is going to be an expert in these fields, one must be able to tell the differences on the other side between among the old liberal theologians. And men spent a lifetime dealing with the differences between the old liberal theologians. And it is perfectly true. If one is going to be an expert in these fields, one has to know the difference between, let us say, Bart and Brunner. One has to know the difference between Bart and Brunner on one side and Reinhold Niebuhr on the other. One has to know the difference between Ryan and Niebuhr and Tillich. One has to know the difference between Tillich and the position that the new theology at Cambridge would have. So if you're going to be an expert in these fields, you have to know the differences among the naturalistic theologians. But let us notice that you mustn't get lost in the differences. What I have just put forth is the proposition that while there are differences, nevertheless, that religious liberalism from the time of the German theology accepting the naturalistic presuppositions until tonight, while it is there are differences in the system, it is one system. So if one is really going to understand religious liberalism, the importance is not so much the differences, though there is reason for studying the differences, among the liberal theologians, but the really important thing is to understand the flow of the system. So therefore, one mustn't get lost among the differences. One must see there is something that can be called religious liberalism, beginning with the acceptance of the naturalistic presuppositions and coming down to the present, and following the surrounding secular, the consensus of the surrounding secular naturalism. And the fact that there is such a thing as such a unity in religious liberalism, and it's really not saying anything different than the surrounding secular naturalism, except these different uses of terms, I think is the real reason to feel a negative, to make a negative critique of liberalism. So my critique of liberalism doesn't turn upon the differences between the theologians, but rather turns upon the weakness of the structure of the whole flow of religious naturalism. And this, therefore, would be my critique of liberalism.